So tonight, we're going to take the black horse. The four horsemen of Revelation 6, of course, have become very well known, even in secular literature. The secular literature typically deals with them quite symbolically, but in any case, tonight we're going to explore the implications, if you will, of Revelation chapter 6, verses 5 and 6. And in Revelation, as you know, in chapter 6, we're opening the first of the seven seals of the sealed book. And in Revelation chapter 6, we have the seals. And when you get down to verse 5, you're opening the third seal. And when he had opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, "Come." And I beheld, and lo, a black horse. And he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four living creatures say, "A measure of wheat for a denarius, three measures of barley for a denarius. And see thou hurt not the oil and the wine." That's it. That's all we know from the text on the third horseman. Now, what does this imagery suggest? He's carrying a pair of balances in his hand. That was a standard thing to measure goods and money and so forth. The announcement goes out that there's a measure of wheat for a penny and three measures of barley for a penny, or a denarius, if you will. It is widely, I think, generally agreed among most conservative scholars that the idiom here speaks of inflation and famine. It may come as a surprise to many to recognize the linkage between those two, because what this speaks toward is that we have a denarius was nominally a day's wage. Someone could work his full wage and get just one meal, unless it was a very economy meal for three. In other words, you could barely make it, if that. He didn't have anything left over for all the other needs of life. So it does imply inflation. It also implies famine. And that's what we're going to really focus on today. We will talk about famine on the planet Earth. But before we do that, we want to lay some groundwork which may surprise you. I think all of us have heard or read of the various famines in various parts of the world at various times, even today, going on. It may surprise you to discover that most 20th century famines are man-made. Most 20th century famines are man-made. And they caused either deliberately or by economic systems that were crippled by corrupt or dictatorial governments. It's interesting that most famines are not caused by nature or the inability of people to produce food, but rather by the policies of governments that are looking out for their own self-centered interests. Through all that, make it impossible for the people to cope with nature or to gather and produce food. One of the most commonly known modern examples of this was the deliberately induced famines imposed by Joseph Stalin in order to on the Ukraine to force the population into compliance. It's interesting that the horseman here speaks of not just famine at the onset of the tribulation, but an economic condition where a man's daily wages are so small that he can barely support himself and his family. In essence, the horrible economic conditions and the specter of famine are interrelated in the end times. They're interrelated today, and they're clearly interrelated in times. Now, it's interesting, as we get into this, you'll discover that the conditions for global famine are almost uniquely being positioned as we speak for a global famine. Normally, famines have been very regionalized, very localized, but it's going to be much, much broader. And it's interesting that almost exclusively in modern times, famines derive from monetary inflation. And that may come as a real surprise. Now, as we get into this, we should try to develop a certain precision, if we can, in our vocabulary. We speak, of course, of recessions, economic recessions or depressions even, and or expansions. That's an economic term. When we speak of inflation or deflation, we're speaking of monetary terms. We live in an economic system where goods are exchanged for various things. What's also a part of that system or a parallel system is the monetary system. And these systems don't necessarily stay in sync. So one of the things that many people are confused by is the difference between the monetary and the economic models. And we want to be sensitive to that as we go. The economic model is what's really going on, real goods and services. The monetary system is what's happening to the measurement elements by which we measure what's going on. Imagine trying to build a house or do some construction if your yardsticks were constantly changing length, if they were elastic somehow. Wouldn't work. One of the things that we depend on is precision and uniformity, if you will, of our measures. And that's one of the things that really corrupts our society is when our basic units are tampered with, manipulated by special interests. Now, we currently have a major economic crisis, financial crisis, in Asia. And it's portrayed by the media as an economic crisis. But it really isn't. The economy in Asia was booming over the past few years. We've heard a lot about the Asian tiger economy, if you will. And so why all of a sudden is there an economic crisis? In reality, Asia is experiencing a currency crisis, not an economic crisis. I mean, one may derive from the other, obviously, but the point is that this idea that there's ongoing booms and busts, symptomatic of our society, is caused primarily by what we're going to get into a little bit, fractional reserve banking. Quite often the media and the academics speak of the boom and bust cycle as if it's something that is just a normal part of economic activity, and that's not true. The only part of the culture that's what really causes it is the manipulation of the money supply, and that manipulation today is worldwide. See, in the past, the manipulation was really constrained to a particular regime, a particular country. But today, because of the way the world's moving, the entire global economy is subject to manipulation, and that will lead to all its attendant evils. We're really going to step back even one step further, because most people, not just Christians, although they're certainly guilty of it, most people do not really understand money. They don't understand the nature, the role of money in society. If we're ignorant about how money really operates, it will lead to the forfeiture of our freedoms and our private property. It'll be a fundamental encumbrance on our stewardship. So we're going to talk a little bit of just the basics. And money is, strangely enough, probably one of the most important fundamental inventions of mankind. Obviously, the love of money leads to greed and other sins, and so very appropriately, we're cautioned in the scripture that the love of money is the root of all evil. But because of that, many Christians overreact and really close their eyes and their understanding to try and understand what is money really. We want to start with that because what is money? How would you define money? And see, without it, a complex modern economy, which is based on the division of labor, the exchange of goods and services, it would be impossible. If it wasn't for money or a money substitute, all of us would have to do all that we need for ourselves. But because of money and what it leads to, it allows job specialization, allows us to develop professions, allows us to develop special skills, knowing that we can trade those skills for other things that we need. So it turns out that's a very basic prerequisite. The best definition that economists seem to have been able to devise, that money is the most marketable commodity in a particular society. Money is the most marketable. Anything you have that is widely marketable can be a money substitute, if you will. That's probably why gold has emerged in the earliest records as one of the popular mechanisms to serve as a unit of value. It served that role for obviously many thousands of years. No seller of gold has ever had to stand begging in the streets, begging people to buy it. It was able to maintain an intrinsic value for a number of reasons we'll go through. There was a time, of course, in primitive culture, still are today, where barter is a form of a business. I'll trade you two sheep for your cow or whatever, you know, that kind of thing. And that obviously is clumsy, awkward. Sooner or later, we want to start getting into something as an intermediate form of barter. And that's really where the whole idea of money came. And I won't go through a whole historical development. Obviously, you can go through a whole list of things that were used as money. Large donut-shaped stones were used by certain tribes. Seashells, even women, were used for barter and as money. And some of these things have proved practical, some have not. How do you go to the supermarket and for something that costs 1.5 women, you know? And a person on my staff suggested that only Solomon could deal with a situation like that for two reasons. He had plenty of women, and he had a lot of experience in dividing things up, so... And, of course, being facetious here. As economies developed and money was needed more and more, ordinary trade gravitated to the use of metals, various metals, although cowrie shells were used in Africa for a long, long time. They even used large stones in certain islands, the Pacific Island of Yap. Pretty soon, though, even the conveyance of coinage or metals or some form of money gets inconvenient. And so it isn't very long before you see the emergence of certificates of ownership substituting. A certificate that somehow authenticated that is a evidence of ownership. You don't actually have to have the gold with you. You can use a certificate that's the equivalent, or gold or whatever acceptable intermediate form of value, storage of value, could be done. Coinage itself was probably invented in China and then reinvented by the Lydians in Turkey. Paper currency also had its origin. That's a whole other development, but also probably well before the 11th century in China. Ancient Babylon had a very, very sophisticated monetary system and also banks and credit. So did Greece, so did Rome. The ancient empires have evidence of having very sophisticated forms of monetary units and forms of credit and banking. Some of that seemed to die out in the Dark Ages, but reemerged in about the 9th century in Europe, and won't go through all of that. But one of the things to recognize is that money does was very essential in some very fundamental cultural ways, because it allowed job specialization, it allowed urbanization, it caused mankind to graduate out of simply an agrarian professional environment. And so you could be expert in one area, knowing that you could trade that expertise, probably with leverage, on other things you needed. Well, what is money really? What are the characteristics? What makes money? It takes at least five things. It should be divisible. Money should be capable of being subdivided into small units in order to count things. Otherwise, it's impossible to make change and so forth. That's pretty obvious. It needs recognizability. Everyone using it has to recognize its intrinsic value or won't accept in trade. One of the problems with, say, for example, gold or silver is that if it's getting into serious transactions, you've got a possibility of being defrauded by its impurity or so forth. You know, you have a validation phase to go through if there aren't some kind of enforced standards. A third thing is portability. You got to be able to carry it around. And obviously large stones or women had some limitations in daily transactions. So obviously certificates can be a substitute, and of course they can be actually traded as money, obviously subject to certain risks. Durability, money has to last. Candle wax would probably not work too well, or you know, you can think of examples that are obviously impractical because they would be a nuisance to keep replacing, et cetera, and so on. And scarcity. Can't be something that's everywhere. Sand on the seashore won't work because it's too easily accessible. It can't store a value. Anyone can go get some. In other words, it has to have some aspect of scarcity in order to hold the value. What's interesting, as you really get sophisticated in your analysis, you'll discover that modern money that you and I are saddled with fails all five tests. Fortunately, it's not obvious to anyone, to everyone, and so it still works to an extent, but we want to examine its frailties. And of course, obviously, as you study money, you discover the advantages of gold, its purity, its usefulness for certain things, and yet scarcity has made it through history, through thousands of years, a relatively reliable mechanism for money, for monetary use. Now, it's interesting, the Bible seems to bear this out. You may recall Abram's servant gave Rebekah gifts of gold in order to entice her to, as part of the package, to come from Laban's family to become the bride of Isaac. When the Israelites fled Egypt, they obviously, God commanded them to collect as repayment for the long servitude, jewels of gold and silver. Exodus chapter 3 deals with some of this. Warned the Israelites not to make gods of silver and gold, as is the common practice among the pagans in that day and the pagans in this day. But, of course, the tabernacle had its most precious elements emblazoned or made of gold as a Levitical symbol of holiness and purity and so forth. And we could go to lots of other examples. The value of metal money was pretty straightforward. You weighed so much gold or whatever it was, and it determined its value, its weight and purity. We even find the scriptures mentioning a talent of silver, talent being a measurement of weight, if you will. As early as the 6th century before Christ, governments are issuing coins that are gold, silver, or copper, obviously with varying values. This coinage system was both a religious as well as a political phenomenon. Each of the city-states, there were cities, but the cities in those days were like a city-state, had its own coinage, had its own local political monopoly over the money. And so did the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire emerges as a republic and then an empire. It did the same thing. It's interesting that the Roman Empire was a religious organization. All ancient societies were. and even our modern societies, although they tried to hide the fact. The emperors ultimately being designated as gods, and later some of them took that quite seriously. And the coins, of course, were used as religious as well as political devices. Now, in an illiterate world, images on the coins, of course, carried religious and political messages. And Tiberius's picture on the coin given to Jesus when he was Caesar is, of course, a well-known example in the scripture. As nations start to mint coins, there's a subtle shift in the nature of money. It becomes something more than just an economic unit. It starts to have a specification that carries with it more than just the weight of the gold or silver, but the image, if you will, of the government that's issuing it. And if they had confidence in the government administration, there was no problem. But also, to the extent that eroded, they had a problem. It's interesting, that started to allow the governments to begin to debase their currency. Instead of a dollar's worth of gold and a dollar coin, using it just idiomatically, they could cheat and make it lighter. And no one really cared as long as it was considered authentic and would be the basis was strictly acceptability. If I get you to take one of those coins, it might not have full value of gold in the coin. You didn't care. It was a unit of measure because you know you could give it to the next person. It was acceptable for traffic. But the minute that happens, you see, the governments then can begin to cheat. They can trade on the general confidence in the government to debase the currency, make the currency itself lacking intrinsic value. No government on the face of the earth has ever, in the historical record, succeeded in resisting that temptation. Not even the United States would come through that. They went from a gold-backed currency, silver-backed currency, and then finally a no-backed currency. By debasing the currency, the government could spend more and accomplish things and empower itself, and it would take time for the economy to recognize that the currency had less value. To give you an example, a very crude example, but to get the idea across, let's assume we could consider in a box all goods and services of an island or an economy. And let's assume there's a certain amount of currency in circulation that equals the value of those goods and services. If I double the amount of currency, I don't create a new value. I simply, any unit of value of what's there will have to be represented by twice as much of the currency. So conceptually it's quite obvious, but in practical terms there's always a time delay. If I have goods and services in the economy and I start adding synthetic money to the economy, it causes inflation. There's no change in the goods and services. It comes about because of the debasement of the currency. We'll get into some of that a little better as we go. All the governments had to do was start mixing lower level metals with their coins. That started the corruption. It was a form of stealing from the people, in effect. And that the Roman emperors took silver out of the denarii. Copper was substituted. It wasn't long before the citizens caught on. And it wasn't very long where that all started to have it come apart. There was the principle that became very obvious was recognized by Sir Thomas Gresham, who was an official in the court of Queen Elizabeth I. He said, bad money drives good money out of circulation. In other words, if there's two kinds of money circulating, the good stuff you'll hoard. You see, and you'll take that, the bad stuff, you'll get rid of. So it turns out pretty soon the bad money drives the good money out of circulation. The good money is being hoarded by people. It's no longer in circulation. So there's more and more. As they debase it, it gets worse and worse. So one of the things that happens when there's two kinds of currencies, the government, you have what's called a two-tier currency. The government, of course, if it's debasing this, you'll end up with two sets of prices. If you've got something to sell, and there's two kinds of currencies, you'll have a price whether it's good or bad money. Government won't like that, so they'll try to make that illegal. And the minute you have the government tampering there, of course, that creates stresses and that thwarts the economy. Historically, these two-tier systems get legislated by most governments under penalty of death. Government's very, very jealous of its monopoly on the money. If that's the case, then, of course, with the bad money coming in, the prices keep getting higher and higher, inflation takes place, and that's exactly what happened in Rome and virtually all empires since. From the time that Tiberius began minting his denarii, it was about 3 centuries later, the Romans increasingly debased their coinage, substituting tin-plated copper and such, and by 300 AD, the denarius was made out of totally worthless base metals. So then they took the next step to control the public's reaction to all of this and started imposing price controls. About 301 AD, Emperor Diocletian imposed wage and price controls, the violation of which was punishable by death. And so this is the whole empire, obviously, is on its path to corruption. It's interesting, in Professor Stauffer's book, Christ and the Caesars, he really chronicles the story of the collapse of the Roman Empire through a study of the progressively debased coinage. And as the empire collapsed, so does the coinage. If increased spending and increased taxation could save an economy, Rome would still be ruling the world. Think about that. Obviously, the inflation and the associated price controls brought on other kinds of woes. Quality and quantity of goods began to decline. Black markets formed to skirt the controls. Police power was brought in to combat that. And productivity declines. Jobs and businesses are lost. The whole thing augurs in pretty quickly. The shortages are usually exacerbated then with attempts at rationing and other things, and on it goes. And the longer the government has the price controls in effect, the deeper the harm occurs. Price controls are essentially people controls. Governments imposing them assume the power to make the decisions that the people should be left alone to make for themselves. In August 15th of 1971, inflation was lowering the value of the dollar by over 4% a year. President Nixon slapped wage and price controls on the nation, and for 3 years that program caused all kinds of predictable problems. When governments are armed with those kinds of powers, seeking violators and the rest of it, you have some of that today, even with the environmental kinds of controls they're attempting. You're moving towards a police state. The American people are gradually getting conditioned to accept that kind of thing, but you're moving step by step towards fascism. The Nixon's poorly enforced program was scrapped finally. Prices still had risen 10% despite all the rules, and 97% of the U.S. corporations were experiencing unusual difficulties in getting supplies. The price controls didn't solve any problems. They just became an additional problem on top of everything else. Now, it turns out that rising prices will invariably destroy people's confidence in the money system. And that loss of confidence is reflected in their loss of confidence in the state itself. They go together. And we can expect more and more of that here. This gets into a whole topic of governmental cheating and the response of the populations against that. But if we start on that, we'll be here all night. Governments quickly find out it's cheaper to print a piece of paper with some dead politician's face on it than it is to mine gold 2 miles under the earth. And so being cheaper, of course, is too big a temptation for politicians not to resort to that in order to accomplish whatever they're trying to accomplish. Suppose you earn $10 for something that you sold or some work you performed. You receive a $10 bill in exchange for your work. That represents the value of the service you performed. It also means that the current market price, that $10, will buy X amount of goods or services. But suppose the government comes along with another $10 bill. Looks just like yours, spends just like yours. The only difference is that government expended nothing to create that $10 bill except the small amount of paper and ink. You had to work for yours. It prints it for free. What just happened to your $10 your $10 in your hand just became worth $5, in effect. Well, you may not realize it, but it does. And you may not have noticed anything happen, and because both $10 bills now will buy the same amount that the earlier one did before that was introduced. And so that's the basic dynamic. It's amazing how few people really understand that. So it's when prices go up, it doesn't mean that the goods or services are worth more. It means it takes more currency to buy the same good. You follow me? And it's amazing how many people do not understand that inflation is a monetary thing, not an economic thing. Your $10 worth of work hasn't changed. It's what people are willing to pay in terms of the media. It's amazing how many ostensibly competent sources are really confused on this point. You and I are told that inflation is a normal part of an healthy economy, and that's a falsehood. It's a normal part of an economy when the monetary system has no sound basis. The biggest problem with inflation is that it continually erodes the value of money that we hold. And we constantly have to keep making more money to stay even, if you will. It's sort of like the rabbit and Alice. You got to keep running to stay in place. And I could go through some examples here, but let's just take one very, very simple. Your dollar in 1940 would buy that which you would have to pay more than $10 today. In over 50 years, we're talking about 6 or 8 cents, actually. Depends which chart you use and some other assumptions. But you need to understand this isn't a minimal thing. It's very, very substantial. And I chose not to resort to charts and graphs, but if you just look at the value of a dollar in 1940 terms, it's staggering. It's really shocking. This doesn't hit all people equally because if you're wealthy, there are maneuvers you can make. You can juggle things around to sort of stay abreast. But if you're someone at the bottom of the pyramid just trying to make it, it hits you the worst. For the middle class, you often manage to roll some of your dollars into tangible assets or income. The whole trick is to convert your labors and efforts into assets that can earn, not just assets you need to use, but assets you can earn. To the extent you can do that, you can start increasing your handle on your income to deal with these things. Now, the thing that's the insidious part of inflation is that it destroys trust and faith in the government. It sets man against man, governments against governments, and it's a tactic also used by governments as a hidden way to force people to pay for programs they would not allow if direct taxation were demanded of them. And it's also a tactic used of those that wish to destroy one social order in order to build tyranny on the ashes of that destruction. And that's the history of mankind, and you could go through, you can portray all of history in those terms, and you need to understand that to understand what's going on today. Hegel has said, history teaches us that man learns nothing from history. Or George Santayana said it another way. He said that anyone that doesn't know history is doomed to repeat it. You need to understand that the most powerful tool of the would-be tyrants are not guns and ammo, it's interest rates and debt and inflation. We're going to take a look at that. Now, one of the things that we need to understand, because the Bible is going to talk prophetically about some things, we need to understand the dynamics of these things. The global inflationary situation is the key to understanding what the Bible is really talking about in the end times. And for the first time in human history, universal inflation on the planet Earth is possible, with all the currencies tied together and none of the currencies with a sound basis, all of them being fiat currencies. When you realize the implications of that, you'll begin to understand better what Revelation 6 is probably alluding to here. Now, one of the things we've talked a little bit crudely, obviously, and superficially, from money to certificates of value, one of the next things we want to talk about, obviously, as you start having transactions in these things, pretty soon there are services that you can benefit by, which leads to the advent of a bank that can store things for you, keep records for you, and also provide a number of services, valid services. But it turns out of the banking community emerges a practice, a structure, that very few people understand, but it's not complicated. It's called fractional reserve banking. Virtually all the economies in the world are inflationary because of the prevalence of that technique. Only Switzerland, and only marginally, has its currencies backed up by gold, but only partially. The only assets backing up your currency. See, bear in mind, remember what currency was. It was a certificate as proof of ownership of some tangible asset, a bar of silver or something. And to be convenient, they use certificates. But out of this, they've gotten to the point where the certificate is not backed by anything except other paper. But no one knows this. The reason we don't is because if I have one, you're perfectly willing to take it as we trade on something. Neither one of us, because we're too busy doing things, stop to realize what are we really dealing with. And it works as long as we have confidence, but we fail to recognize that confidence erodes in small pieces. And so we're dealing with a slippery issue here. The actual mechanism of fractional reserve banking changes from country to country, but the principles are all the same. The money by the bank is created out of thin air, no backing. It's loaned to people of the country who then must continually pay interest for the money that's been loaned by the creating or the lending institution. And it's a system in which people discover slowly that they have to run a little faster and faster to earn the same amount of buying power because the development of credit keep growing. And as the credit grows, you got to keep running hard to keep up with it. You'll see some examples as we go here. There are security problems with physical money. Money has always been difficult to move around, particularly if there's too much of it. And so that leads, of course, to the idea of a bank. If you put on deposit some assets, and I was the banker, based on those assets, make loans to other people, because I could count on the fact that not everybody that has deposits with me are going to come at the same time. So it didn't take me long to figure out that I could make more loans than I have deposits. I can give these fancy names, but that's the net of it. That's where all the trouble really starts. A very simple form of banking was practiced by the ancient temples in Egypt, Babylonia, and Greece, which loaned at very high rates of interest and on the gold and silver deposited for safekeeping. Private banking existed in 600 BC, well developed by the Greeks, Romans, and Byzantines. Medieval banking was dominated, strangely enough, by the Jews and Levantines because of the strictures of the Catholic Church against usury, because many other occupations were closed to those people. So that was all that was available, so they developed expertise in them. The forerunners of modern banks were chartered for a specific purpose, the Bank of Venice, the Bank of England. They were chartered in connection with loans to the government and so forth. And I don't want to weary you with too much of this history, but the point is that the recognition that not everybody would make a demand at the same time led to the opportunity that since few people ever came or asked for all their gold at one time, they could loan out the gold and silver to third parties, charge them interest for their depositors' money. They could loan it at a higher rate than they gave their depositors. In fact, in the early days, they even charged the depositors for storage. So you can see the picture. So that's where they made their profit. At this point, let's talk about the early United States. The currency of the United States really was, in those early days, the currency of last resort for the whole world. And so we're going to examine two meetings, fateful meetings, that altered the course of history. The forthcoming euro in Europe may also turn out to be a meeting, an event of that same weight. The American colonists originally had a disastrous experience with paper fiat money. It didn't have any credibility, and it was a major, major disaster. In 1764, the British Parliament stepped in and outlawed irredeemable paper money in the colonies, and immediately gold coins from Europe began circulating as money. The stability it provided, of course, led to a lot of progress and a good fortune. But then came the Declaration of Independence, the War for Independence. In order to finance the war effort, the Continental Congress turned to the issuance of paper fiat money. Many of the colonists refused to accept the Continentals, as they were called, these paper bills. And so the governments did what they always have done. They passed legal tender laws compelling people to accept the paper money, trying to make that work. And, of course, people who knew the difference between gold and paper money continued to use the former and not the paper. They still have an expression you hear around, not worth a Continental. It actually goes back to the Revolutionary War. Doesn't refer to Ford's car product. So one of the main points, finally, of the Continental Convention was the need to ban the issuance of worthless paper money. The delegates finally decided to bar the federal government from issuing paper money. From that day on, American European bankers always sought to somehow create a central bank. And interestingly enough, as you read the history, people in those days were much more sophisticated than people today, because the population in those days understood the dangers of having a dominant central bank. Today, most people aren't interested, they don't care, it's boring stuff, not paying attention. They don't realize what the real dynamics are. By the way, Baron Nathan Meyer de Rothschild, as most people could say, has a very interesting quote. He says, "Let me issue and control a nation's money, and I care not who writes the laws." See, he became powerful because he understood the dynamics of money. Karl Marx in the Communist Manifesto said, "Money plays the largest part in determining the course of history." He said, "Gee, Chuck, why are we getting into all this?" Because the Bible tells us not to be ignorant of Satan's devices. Paul warns us that we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of darkness of this world, against the spiritual wickedness in high places. And unless you understand these devices, you will not understand history, and therefore will not understand what's forthcoming. Let me give you an example of one who worked very, very hard at this area, a guy by the name of Abraham Lincoln. He worked hard to prevent the attempts of the Rothschilds, the European Rothschilds, to involve themselves in financing the Civil War. And interestingly enough, just a footnote you might find fascinating, it was the Tsar of Russia that provided the needed assistance against the British and the French, who were going to be the driving forces against the secession of the South and her subsequent financing. The Russians intervened by providing naval forces for the Union blockade of the South, by letting both countries know, Britain and France, that if they attempted to join the Confederacy, that they would have war with Russia. It's a fascinating irony of history that Russia was pivotal in helping establish or maintain, if you will, our union. But anyway, the Rothschilds' interest did succeed, however, in through an agent, Treasury Secretary Salmon B. Chase, to force a bill called the National Banking Act through Congress, creating a federally chartered central bank that had the power to issue U.S. banknotes. Now, here's the reason I'm bringing it up. Lincoln then warned the people as follows, quote, "The money power preys upon the nation in the time of peace, and it conspires against it in times of adversity. It is more despotic than monarchy, more insolent than autocracy, more selfish than bureaucracy." And that's selfish. "I see in the near future a crisis approaching that unnerves me and causes me to tremble for the safety of our country. Corporations have been enthroned. An era of corruption will follow. The money power of the country will endeavor to prolong its reign by working upon the prejudices of the people until the wealth is aggregated in a few hands and the republic is destroyed," close quote. He continued to fight against the central bank, and some historians now believe that it was his anticipated success in influencing the Congress to limit the life of the Bank of the United States to just the war years that was the motivating factor behind his assassination. Modern researchers have uncovered evidence of a massive conspiracy that links Lincoln's Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, to John Wilkes Booth, his 8 co-conspirators, and 70 government officials and businessmen that were involved in the conspiracy with the Bank of Rothschild. When Booth's diary was recovered by Stanton's troops, it was delivered to Stanton. When it was later produced during the investigation, 18 pages had been ripped out. Those pages, containing the names of the people I just ran off, were later found in the attic of one of Stanton's descendants. From Booth's trunk, a coded message was found that linked him directly to Judah B. Benjamin, a Civil War campaign manager for the South in the House of Rothschild. When the war ended, the key to the code was found in Benjamin's possession. Now, you know the story. The assassin was portrayed as a lone, crazed gunman. That's where the myth of the lone gunman began. It's a great, deep, long-standing American tradition. Okay? No, really. I'm sometimes flippant, but it's the assassin who was portrayed this way was a few of his radical friends escaped by way of the only bridge in Washington not guarded by Stanton's troops. This guy Booth, or whoever he really was located hiding in a barn near Port Royal, Virginia. 3 days after escaping from Washington, he was shot by a soldier named Boston Corbett, who fired without orders. Whether or not the man was killed was Booth is still a matter of contention. But the fact remains that whoever it was that was killed, he had no chance to identify himself with the Secretary of War of Stanton that made the final determination. Some now believe that a dupe was used and that the real John Wilkes Booth escaped with Stanton's assistance. Mary Todd Lincoln, upon hearing of her husband's death, began screaming, "Oh, that dreadful house." And earlier historians felt that this spontaneous utterance was referred to the White House. Some now believe that it may have been directed to Thomas W. House, a gunrunner, financier, and agent of the Rothschilds during the Civil War, who was linked to the anti-Lincoln pro-banker interests. You say, well, gee, Chuck, that's an interesting episode in history. Let me move on. Andrew Jackson was the first president west of the Appalachians. He was unique at the time for being the first one elected by voters without the direct support of a recognized political organization. He vetoed the renewal of the bank charter, the charter for the Bank of the United States on July 10th of 1832. In 1835, he declared his disdain for the international bankers. Quote, "You are a den of vipers. I intend to rout you out, and by the eternal God, I will rout you out. If the people only understood the rank injustice of our money and banking system, there would be a revolution by morning." There followed an unsuccessful attempt to assassinate him. Jackson told his vice president, Martin Van Buren, "The bank, Mr. Van Buren, is trying to kill me." So whether he's right or not, who knows, but Jackson believed it was the bankers after him. Now you sort of wonder, is there a pattern here? Let's go on. James Garfield. President James Abram Garfield, our 20th president, had previously was chairman of the House Committee on Appropriations and was an expert in fiscal matters. Upon his election, among other things, he appointed an unpopular collector of customs in New York, whereupon two senators from New York, Roscoe Conkling and Thomas Platt, resigned their seats. President Garfield openly declared that whosoever controls the supply of currency would control business and activities of all the people. After only 4 months in office, guess what happened? President Garfield was shot at a railroad station on July 2, 1881.